Hello again, everybody. Welcome back to the Buddhist Center podcast with me, Chandradasa, and I'm very happy to say also with my friend and colleague, Kusala Devi, who's joining us as part of the team again, which feels really great. It's very nice for me not to have to do these things on my own, so I'm delighted to welcome you back, Kusala Devi.
Hi, everyone listening. Yeah, great to be back on the podcast again. I hadn't been on for quite some time, but this is my second one within a week, which is wonderful. And I'm particularly looking forward to the conversation today. I was with two of our guests on a day retreat a couple of weeks ago with Singhasree and Balaji in Nottingham. So yeah, really looking forward to hearing what they've got to say, and also Viveka, of course. Yeah.
Yes, thanks. You've just heard our wonderful guests for today. Balaji, Singhasree and Viveka, in alphabetical order, are old friends of the Buddhist Center Online at this point. And also, you might recognize them from a podcast we did last year, and also a home retreat we did last year, which we'll touch on. And I'm very happy to say they're going to be coming back for more this year. Later in October, we'll be running a home retreat on the Buddhist Center Live called The Three Bodies of Belonging, which is a title I absolutely love. We had really great fun on the team coming up with images for The Three Bodies of Belonging. Some really fantastic dynamic images, which you might have seen on your social media. So I'm going to welcome our guests first, and then we'll just touch a bit on last year's work and how it relates to this year's work. But first of all, I'm going to start with earliest in the morning in the different time zones of this call. Welcome to you, Viveka.
Thank you. Yeah, that's kind of you. Help my system wake up by saying hello. Yeah, it's good to be here. Just you saying the three bodies of belonging, I can feel the resonances beginning to quiver in this body. I use she and they pronouns, and I'm here on Ohlone land, the original peoples of what we now call the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the proud resident of the Excelsior neighborhood, which is one of those neighborhoods which, you know, it's kind of like the underdog neighborhoods in a city that the residents feel very much like we want to uplift. So yes, the Excelsior, which is a lovely neighborhood full of immigrant families and houses that have little gardens in the back. Mm. Yeah, and it is not quite 8 o'clock in the morning.
Extra heroic wiki, points wiki for you. Fantastic. And from the Pacific time zone here in the US, we'll sip across the Atlantic to our good friend Singhasree, who's in London. Welcome, Singhasree.
Thank you so much. It's really good to be here. I just loved hearing Viveka describe a little bit of her neighborhood in San Francisco, which I can readily call to mind, having lived there for quite a long time and recently visited her home there. Yeah, also wondering, Viveka, if it's sunny or foggy, because it's also a neighborhood that's known for its fog.
Very foggy. It's officially summer, everyone. Get your wool cardigan on to start the day.
Yeah, so that Mark Twain, he said he spent his coldest winter, it was his summer in San Francisco.
Yes, that's right.
Don't tell the tourists. So yeah, I'm in London now, where I live with my partner, and I use she, they pronoun. And also just wanted to say something that was evoked seeing all of you here on the screen, but also specifically connecting with Viveka, is that I'm pretty sure that right now would be like the bardo between my private and public ordination, and Viveka is my private preceptor. So it's 14 years since that really special time. So I'm very much in touch with my own ordination and also friends that are up at Akashvabana right now about to have their public ordination.
Can you tell us a bit about your neighborhood?
Yeah, this is the COVID move. We needed a bit more space, and we found a lovely little house in Muswell Hill, which is in North London. And it feels like a little village. I'm assuming at some point it was a little village before it got swallowed up by the big smoke. We've got a beautiful church that rings on the hour, and we've literally got the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker on the high street, like one right after the other. So yeah, I love living here. It's very oldie worldy.
Fantastic. Balaji, hello again. Very lovely to have you with us, and also the monkey in the background. It's a soft toy that we can see, that unfortunately our podcast listeners can't see. Welcome to you. How are you? Where are you?
Yeah, I'm well. Yeah, I'm really pleased to be here. So I'm in Birmingham, UK, right in the center of the UK. I use pronouns he, him. I'm also a bit like Singhasree. I'm also in a village that's been swallowed up by the big city. So yeah, I'm in Sturchley Village, which is like South Birmingham.
We're very glad to have you with us. It's very nice actually hear where everybody is. Kusala Devi, you didn't tell us much about where you are. You're in Nottingham in the UK, right? What's your neighborhood?
Yeah, so I'm in an area of Nottingham called Snenton, which is quite close to the city centre. I particularly enjoy it because it's very sort of culturally and ethnically diverse here. So my road is a wonderful mix of different families and people. But there's also a working windmill very nearby, which I also enjoy, a freshly milled rye flour, which is beautiful.
I have seen the windmill. It's amazing. Actually, you get to go inside and the big stones that move and grind the flour. I suppose I should say I'm in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on the East Coast. So we're, how many time zones have we got? Three time zones on this call. It's also a little village with a clock tower that rings on the hour, sing a shri all night, I should say. In fact, I was lying listening to it last night at midnight, counting them, thinking, oh, it's midnight. It's actually very beautiful. I feel very lucky to live here. And I'm slightly ashamed to say we have no fog. In fact, it's been really lovely summer here on the East Coast in the US. Perfect dates of a podcast conversation. So thanks, everybody, for coming. This particular conversation is occasioned by your generous offering of another home retreat this year on the Buddhist Center Live. I was thinking, actually, when I was doing the prep for this, we usually, when the podcast is about home retreat, evoke home retreats in a particular way, which I could do. But I actually wondered, from your experience of doing it last time, and I know all of you work on different platforms online at different times, can you give people a sense of why home-based practice is effective? Because it's one of these things that has survived the COVID pandemic and taken on a life of its own as a way to at least augment other kinds of practice in person or in different forms of community. Wondered if any of you have any thoughts about that, given that it was a year ago.
Firstly, some people don't have the choice about whether to go to a retreat in person or not. For some people, it can be a bit of a lifeline to being in community and in practice, really. So I think that's great. The other thing I think is, in some ways, the home environment can fit in with people's routine. So, they might be just easier for them to go on an online retreat or be more available than having to wait for a time where they've got to travel and be out of their home environment. Often people's home environment gives an opportunity to practice the Dharma in an environment which they're generally in, managing other aspects of their life as well. So I think there's something quite valuable about having it like an injection of the Dharma and the Sangha into your home environment, which you spend a lot of your time in when, for example, you're not away on retreat. So I think there's quite a lot that online retreats can offer for people.
Yeah, I was just going to say something similar to that in terms of integration. I think, especially for folks who may find it harder to meditate at home, it can kind of help to establish a muscle memory. Maybe it's the first time you set up a shrine for yourself in a space to meditate at home and to get that muscle memory of sitting there and getting on with your meditation practice with others. And I want to just qualify this by saying I don't want to assume that the home is a safe space for everyone. And for a lot of us, home is a safe and familiar space. And I think there is something about how that can help us to relax a little bit more easily. We're eating food that we know we've prepared for ourselves, that we like to have. It's also lovely to be cooked for on retreat, but for some people that can be trickier. You're in your own space, it's familiar, so, and it can feel safe, and that can just support a sense of just dropping in maybe more readily, more quickly, more fully. And I'll also just name this one last thing, which is some people choose to do a home retreat by taking themselves off onto a solitary retreat and then joining a home retreat, which is also very creative. And I appreciate the creativity of that for folks who maybe they want to go on retreat, but nothing that works for their schedule that's available residentially. So you can kind of do this hybrid solitary and plugging into something that's being offered more collectively.
Yeah. And also, online retreats offer a very diverse retreat body, retreat community, which I especially appreciate when there's so much global strife, and it actually helps my body in the practice of compassion, just to be able to span the globe a bit more and be in some kind of intimate, heartfelt connection with people across those lines that get drawn on maps that demarcate us as being in separate places. But I really especially appreciate that about the Buddhist Center online generally. And I feel like this is one of the places where something really beautiful and special can be offered through this platform. Yeah, so just having a moment of appreciating all that gets done to make that possible.
I'll just add that the great thing about these home retreats as well is that we do record the material and then often supplement it with lots of other materials. So for myself, I know that I've sometimes done the home retreat, but at a later time, if I couldn't make the actual dates, then I could take a week of my time and use the recordings by doing that as a solitary retreat at home, which has been fantastic just to have such a wealth of resources available.
I'm from the international side of things. We had to decide on consensus time for a baseline of some kind. So with Singha Sri and Balaji being in the same time zone, for some people, I know for myself, there'll be things that are beyond my desire to wake out of a bed for, be so early. Thanks for that reminder that, oh yeah, I don't need to wake up in the pitch black an hour after I've laid my head down.
Yeah, it's good to have that reminder actually that you can basically do this anytime you like. So there are different flavors, I think, with the home retreats that we do. And it might be that you're not going to do any of this material at all, but I think the approach to the Dharma that we're going to talk about today is really relevant to anyone practicing. If you do want to come on and be in a live experience of online community, the retreat is called The Three Bodies of Belonging. Very mysterious, beautiful title that we're going to dive into today. And it's going to take place between October the 25th and the 31st this year, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, the dates are going to be slightly different. We'll note anything on the events page with time zones on this particular retreat. We're going to start in the second session of the day, for example, to make sure that everybody is welcome into the first sharing of the day. I actually love this aspect of doing international home retreats, just trying to figure all this stuff out. It's always impossible, but the joy is in the work of trying to make it happen anyway. And we're always super moved that people will get up in the middle of the night and join these retreats. It's amazing. Every single time someone shows up at a very, very strange hour for doing online practice just because they want to be present with others. It's really moving. But yeah, we'll have the recordings up. You can take part anytime you like. I guess the place to start with this particular retreat is the title, The Three Bodies of Belonging. Now, your last retreat last year on the Buddhist Center was centered on emotions. It was called Forces for Good, Challenging Emotions as Portals to Liberation. And it wasn't just on emotions themselves, it was on emotional life as an arena in which we might move towards freedom. I know for all three of you, and on that retreat to embodied practice is absolutely crucial to this. And in this new retreat, the focus shifts to that experience, and I guess the metaphor of the body too, or the bodies, plural. Maybe we could have an introduction to the idea of the three bodies in Buddhism. And I should know, if you're a Netflix watcher, this is not the same as the three body problem. It's a different three bodies. That's an awesome three bodies, but this is a different awesome three bodies. I would love somebody to do some work on how to bring them both together as concepts. So we'll do a little evocation of the three bodies in Buddhism and how the idea of the three bodies relates to practicing in our own bodies. I thought we could maybe start with a quote that you'll find on the event page, which we'll include in the show notes. And this is a quote from Sangharakshita, who's the founder of the Tratna Buddhist order, of which we are all members. And it's a very short glossing, very handy gloss of the three bodies, or kayas, as they're known in the tradition. And I thought it'd be neat if we could read a section each. So you guys have got this in front of you. Take your favorite kaya and let's hear a little bit about them via Sangharakshita from his seminar on the songs of Milarepa. And then in a way, we can evoke them in our own way.
Yeah, you can imagine the songs of Milarepa, so the original inspiration being in what's now known as Tibet, high mountains of Tibet, is where Milarepa, a very free and fun and compassionate awakened practitioner. Okay, so Sangharakshita describes the Dharmakaya is the embodiment or the perfection of mind. Mind meaning here the deepest part of oneself. Because it is with that deepest part of oneself that one realizes the ultimate. So Dharmakaya corresponds to mind. What is mind in a Buddha is Dharmakaya.
In the same way, Sambhogakaya corresponds to speech. What in us is speech or communication principle in a Buddha is Sambhogakaya. So in the Buddha's Sambhogakaya form, in the Buddha's ideal form, the Buddha's archetypal form, the Buddha communicates with others on the same spiritual level and communicates with other Buddhas and with highly advanced bodhisattvas.
And then Nirmanakaya corresponds with, it literally means body of transformation. What is Nirmanakaya in a Buddha, in us, is physical body. Our physical body determines where we are. The fact that we have a physical body means that we exist at a certain point in space and a certain point in time.
That was all very exciting to hear. That's the kind of overview from Sangharakshita on the three bodies, a nice pithy rendering of them corresponding to body, speech, and mind. And maybe later we can talk some more about other kinds of correspondences. On this retreat, why did you choose that metaphor, that central metaphor of the three bodies of belonging as the way you want to explore practice with others?
Well, one thing I love about this teaching is it is both very simple, direct, and helpful, you know, just helpful. And we're talking about a home retreat being something quite practical to be in your home. And it's quite practically helpful. And we can unpack that a little bit more later, what we find helpful about it. And it's also very profound. Some of the highest levels of awakening teaching in Buddhism can sometimes appear as if they're quite hard to gain access to. They're sometimes described as ungraspable, so they might be quite hard to grasp. But I really love this teaching because it takes this the real heart of what the freedom that Buddhism's trying to offer, that people, especially maybe those that are interested in meditation, are following some longing for freedom in some way. And by exploring this three bodies of belonging, it really is a way to explore this as something that's not out there, ungraspable in the sense that we can never get it because it's out there, but actually explore how this very being, this community, this collective, this world right here is where we will actually discover what we're longing for.
I'm just remembering at some point, maybe about 10 years ago or so, it occurring to me that the Buddha woke up with the same six senses that I currently have access to. And there was something about that that was very affirming. Like, oh, it's not like I have to extract myself, whatever that means, quite mysterious, the sense of self, out of this body into some like new enlightened body. This is the body. This is the very body that will awaken into the truth of the collective body and the universal body. So I find that very inspiring, affirming, confidence-inducing, faith-giving. And then there is also something for me about the mysterious true individuality, which is what Bhante refers to when we are considered having seen through a fixed sense of self, seen through doubt on the path and any methods that we might be clinging to, like the end of those strategies. Yeah, there's something about how that's also achievable in this body, and that that's not something that we have to wait a very, very long time to have happen. And that something about that language, it's not just our body. Our body is never just our body. So this idea of I'm practicing as an individual, but also opening into collectivity and on deeper and deeper levels. So that's what this teaching evokes for me, is a loosening of a fixed sense of the self within an individual body, but also the mysteriousness of how it also happens within what appears as an individual body.
I think for me, just following on really, what Singha Sri was saying is that it's like we had the physical body, but there's a potential for so much more. The Tikai teaching for me gives a kind of vision of human potential. As we were just hearing from Sangha Akshati, we all potentially have access with the right conditions and good teachings to the deepest part of ourselves. And then that deepest part of ourselves wants to communicate, and it communicates with qualities that can enrich our lives, bring creativity, energy, compassion, contentment, you know, such a long list of qualities, which can then kind of grace us in time and space as a human being in this planet in relationship with other people, really. So I think in a time where there's a lot of loneliness and a lot of isolation and a lot of polarization, and we lack the bigger vision, we see ourselves as things separate from other things and easily get into competition with, it gives this beautiful vision of going on a journey of transformation. And somehow this Tikai teaching holds those different aspects for me. So there's just so much to explore there, really, so much to explore.
Generally, I feel like what draws the three of us together, you know, why would three practitioners at this point in their Dharma lives, I don't know how many years in we each are, it adds up to a lot of seeking out what seems to work. Yeah. And the resonance between the three of us that I appreciate or have picked up is this bringing together of helping people come home to the body. You know, there's so many reasons that one might want to move away from that sensory experience, that feelingness, the feelingness of being embodied. There's so many reasons why that might have been too much or in our conditions because of maybe past harm or hurt or brokenheartedness or another list of things. Yeah, there's so many lists of wonderful awakening qualities. There's so many lists, endless lists of how human beings can be hurt or be hurting. Yeah, so there's also something about this that maybe can be in the archetype of healing, that the whole area of relationship, the relationship to one's own life as we experience it here tangibly in the body, and then through that healing also the healing of relationship. And sometimes Buddhism uses rather maybe helpful words for conceptual frameworks, but I feel like we have all been in the pursuit of the experiential. What might that mean? We are all interconnected. How can we actually know that, feel that, experience that, so it becomes more real? The reality of that is known deeply.
Just picking up on what Viveka was saying about one of the ways that I've been describing this retreat to people is it's an embodied and relational approach to awakening. So there's something about those two words, embodied and relational, that in my own practice, in my own experience, co-arise. You know, as soon as I get closer to the raw experience in the body, there's a relationship there. And sometimes it's not an easy relationship. So there can be resistance, there can be numbing out, there can be shutting down, there can be pushing away, there can be grasping after sensation, experience. And a clear seeing of that is also a way to be free of it. So it's like moving towards, like a paradox, can feel quite contradictory, like start to move towards that which we might normally turn away from or habitually block out of our experience. When we can learn to come into relationship with it from a place of awareness and love, then something else becomes possible. One of the things I love about this way of working is then the implications for how we relate to each other in the world also reveal themselves. So it's humbling work, and its riches are so satisfying, deeply, so deeply satisfying, more deeply satisfying than we can even imagine. And it's a gradual process. You know, go back to Bhante and one of his core tenets, it's a gradual process. It's not like we go from being completely unembodied and cut off to totally open and in relationship with everything. We can just start right now with what's here, even if what's here is no sense of our bodies. You know, just getting curious about what that's like. What is it like to feel so numb, to feel so cut off? How is that for us? What is that doing for us? What's the potential integrity in that, actually? How has that protected us? How has that kept us safe?
I find this teaching very mysterious and sometimes a bit difficult to get my head around. But what I've really appreciated in the blurb that you shared and what it looks like you'll be exploring is what you just started to touch on there. So these more poetic themes for the three kayas, that first one being coming home to the body. And yeah, you touched on the fact that for some of us that might not necessarily feel easy. So I wonder if we could just go into those poetic themes a bit more. So maybe for that first one around coming home to the body, how might we learn to belong in our own bodies again?
There's something really fundamental here for me, knowing what the difference is between our thoughts and concepts and what is actual body experience. The Buddha talks about this a lot in his teachings, and there's a lot of our practices are geared towards helping us clarify this, really. So knowing a thought as a thought, knowing a sound, a smell as a smell, a taste as a taste, a body sensation as a body sensation. And we are storytelling animals, but the problem is we don't know often that that's what we're doing. You know, we don't see that that's what we're doing. And obviously, a lot of our suffering is caught up in our stories about ourselves and about others. So I think there's something potentially, there's a whole process of connecting with our bodies and discovering our bodies. And then so often, I mean, I'm speaking personally as well from my own experience here. What I found as the stories started to loosen is that I discovered that I was very numb. You know, I didn't really feel much in the heart. I didn't feel much in the belly. There wasn't much aliveness or sensation or even feeling. And then for me, you know, there's this sense of, oh, right, there's quite a lot of work to do here now. And then that gradual process of developing trust that it can be helpful and fruitful to start to rest attention on the body. Sometimes it's too much and we need a bit of a break, but having that general orientation to start to sense into the body and be with the body over time. And then an alchemy can start to happen, where what was blocked starts to move, or what was contracted starts to have a bit more space and release, and energy is released. And we find that we can start to turn around more contracted states of mind and emotions and gradually gain trust. And then it says, well, where does this end? This unraveling, this release of tension, this sense of maybe even qualities starting to appear. But I do think, like Singer Shri said, was really key for me, which is seeing how are we with our experience? How are we with our thoughts? How are we with our body experience? The traditional Buddhist teaching is the poisons, you know, that we either want what we haven't got, fight what we have got, or just ignore or deny our experience. So I think that's really key. And seeing that what's really needed, what we really need to learn, is an attitude of hospitality, welcoming, curiosity. That for me is what seemed to drive a lot of the whole process, really.
Gosh, there's so much in that, Balaji. And I love the fact that you described us as storytelling animals. In a way, if this podcast has a point, not sure if it has to have a point, but if it does have a point, it's about us being storytelling animals, and in this case, storytelling Buddhists. I notice I respond really positively to that language of welcoming and hosting, and your thematic sense of it, befriending. And in some ways, it's quite easy for me, at least, to imagine doing that in relationship to a dynamic and positive and flowing sense of relationship and community. I noticed at the start of the conversation, you mentioned loneliness, and maybe I guess another aspect of that is meaninglessness, seeing the world and feeling in a way just overwhelmed by what's happening in the world, which in terms of the body, I suppose, comes back to all the stuff about the body keeping the score and the fact that most of us hold some kind of experience of trauma. How do you go about, and how on this retreat will we go about befriending the harder aspects of experience, you know, thinking specifically about trauma and just the grief of being in the world, never mind all of our personal griefs, specific griefs?
Yeah, what a good question, Chandrasa. I just spent 4 days with a community of somatics teachers led by someone named Stacey Haynes, who has done a deep study into somatics, trauma, and resilience. And actually, I'm coming into this day feeling quite tender. I've been in my own, I guess, coming a bit closer to the part of me that, on behalf of our world, knows some suffering, is being real in that way. And then just being with others who were also bringing their stories, the life in them that holds that particular vibration of the human experience. One thing is that I feel we need to be resourced. Right. So we need to come out of isolation and to be resourced. One of the beliefs that can ripple around is I should be able to do this, or there's something wrong with me, or I'm broken if I can't be in this world, you know, but so many people are trying to do that without resourcing, you know, and that resourcing can be connection, actual teachings, which we'll be offering on this retreat, methods, practices for resourcing, helping the body have more capacity to hold more of what life's experience is in its full range, to hold our histories. There's a lot of meaning that can come out of suffering, right? There's a lot of learning that can come out of suffering, including how to heal. But we need resourcing to turn into that material, to welcome that material. So healing happens in community, really. And I think that's a very important thing, not to overlook that. I mean, I suppose the whole project we have here of putting so much energy in Tri Ratna into building community is, and make that explicit, like we can grow, we can help each other transform, help us hold the suffering that is in our own bodies and in the world. So just say that, I mean, these two people I'm with here teaching, I think resourcing is a huge part of what your work is. I just was so moved by this 4 days, and I just can't even, you know, it makes me a little bit teary right now. Just, I'm feeling more and my body's softer. There's armoring that has fallen away and I'm feeling more. And just aware, even this morning, you know, I need to be mindful not to just go back into being a mechanized, a machine, you know, just start answering 6,000 emails right away. Like, there's actually some that needs to be respected here. My body actually has a knowing about what it can do, how it can be now, to let this ripen. And yeah, it's an ongoing process. And just feeling a lot of appreciation for the people I was with this last 4 days.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Vivek. I really appreciate the space you're in and can barely relate to it from times when I've been in similar
gatherings around supporting and being part of participating in collective healing and transformation. I get that feeling a lot when I've been on retreat, actually, coming home off retreat and wanting to really support the system and integrating the change that's happened. Well, as you said, the armoring that's dropped away, the deeper sense of connection that's been established. And yeah, I really appreciate you bringing the word resourcing. I was just actually on a retreat. Valjeet and I were leading a retreat quite recently where one of the retreatants came to a practice review with me and said, thank you so much for encouraging me to find my resources and to trust in my resources and to know that I actually have resources, even if I haven't ever used that word to describe what I'm doing to take care of myself. And that it was so helpful to have it framed that way and to be encouraged that we can both know what our resources are and how to access them readily. And one of the things that is really important to me in this way of working is also knowing what brings a sense of safety, which resources are that and so much more. So they are things that can support a sense of safety in the body. One of the riches of coming home to the body is being able to sense in more and more subtle and deeper levels what safety actually feels like in the body. And then also like respond with some conviction to address times and places and situations in which we don't necessarily feel as safe as we could in our body. Some of that's within our control, some of it's not. And I'm sure that Sangharaksha's emphasis on conditions and the importance of establishing helpful conditions for practice, he didn't necessarily use the language of safety, but when I look back at those teachings, I think, oh, that's definitely what he's getting at there. And then looking back at the Buddha and not just what he taught, but the example of his life, I sense that the use of the word refuge, for example, I have this working theory now that the Buddha was not speaking metaphorically. I think he was actually speaking literally. In his awakening experience, what he woke up into was a deep, complete, full, total sense of feeling safe within his own body, within his own embodiment, and able to sort of maintain that connection with a deep sense of safety, being in touch with his own dignity, his own value, his own worthiness as a living being, having a real felt sense of belonging to all things and everybody all the time, no matter what was happening. So what you're saying about building resilience, imagine having that kind of resilience, that kind of, well, in somatics, we use the term window of tolerance, which is the window within which we can tolerate discomfort. So my working theory is that I think the Buddha might have just blown his window of tolerance right wide open to the point where it didn't have any more boundaries. You know, it's like totally open, totally able to be with whatever is here. And I'm finding it in my own practice very helpful to really feel into that. Trying to imagine that and then feeling in my body how that feels to try and imagine what that state must be like.
Just carrying on from what you were saying there, Singhasri, about the window of tolerance. Trauma is sometimes described as arising because there was too much too quickly. You know, the system was overwhelmed and we end up with this kind of legacy. The American Buddhist teacher, Reginald Ray, calls it the unlived. You know, our body is trying to, our nervous system is trying to cope with a lot of unlived emotions in our system, grief, anger, shame, despair, and in particular, fear. And this can be really debilitating in life, which really for me feeds into our whole Buddhist practice of waking up. We're going to be much more prone to anxiety, drowsy, sloth and torpor, doubt, ill will. But from my experience, when the system feels safe enough and turns towards the body, the system can metabolize and process the unlived. If things are slowed down and the system feels safe enough, it can live the unlived, so to speak. And this is a very wholesome, healthy, organic process. And there's so much in the Triratna system that support that. And I would say particularly the importance of supportive friendships and supportive communities as providing a kind of broader container of support and guidance in this area. So yeah, I think healing trauma is such an integral part of the path. And it's unresolved trauma, I'd say, that eclipses us from the qualities of the Trikaya. So it's a very fruitful potential path to follow.
Yeah, I got stirred when you were speaking about it, about the unlived and living unlived. And just to say that And I come from a culture where the basic understanding of who I am is actually more a collective identity. I notice this more because when I'm in some context in the US, you know, there can be a dominant cultural notion of an I as a singular entity. But my baseline being descended from Chinese people and culture is a collective we identity. And I was very struck in the last 4 days that a lot of other people who come from that kind of cultural way of being, when we are actually working with the body and coming to the body, we're also with our ancestors. You know, there's a healing backwards towards our lineages. And that unlivedness can stretch time also. It's not just about linear time in this particular, how many years I've been in chronological time on this planet. And the quote from Sangharakshita earlier mentioned being bodhisattvas. And I feel like, oh, this is maybe a connection, a being with a boundless heart. When we're healing or opening that window of tolerance so we can be with more experience, we can actually then, when we're ready, as we're ready, as it feels like, oh, this is what is possible now, we can actually hold more beings. It's quite an amazing thing. So there might be some people that relate to that, maybe even have practice with ancestors that might have a sense of what I'm speaking about here.
Mm. We've heard about coming home to the body and then the importance of befriending, being supported in community. I think that takes us really nicely into our third poetic theme of opening ourselves up to the luminous and boundless dimension of the awakened being. Again, this is something that might sound sort of straightforward, but actually isn't so easy. So what really is it to truly open ourselves up? And what can get in the way for us?
How about we trust that our fundamental nature is already completely open, boundless, luminous? I was struck by Balaji's evocative description there of what gets in the way or limits that. Something about this way of working is like appreciating that we have to start with where we are and what we've got, and connecting how we are with the states of contraction, actually. It starts to become more fully into the body and come into relationship with these parts of holding and contraction, and also get curious about the conditions that create that in relationship with others in the world and with ourselves. In this way of working, we can start to get glimpses of that. And one of the practices that I actually personally have benefited so much from, and I hope we can get into on this retreat, is just appreciating that in meditation, we can drop into more relaxed, open, at ease, calm, tranquil, spacious state, and that they're not that far away. Mindful to breathing, sometimes a few breaths on long retreat, just being able to drop more into a steadier place, and then being able to then notice the inherent openness of that space, and then how what usually is coming and going and we're getting kind of buffeted about by and drawn into and caught up in and identified with can still be there, but it's just not a problem anymore. It's not taking us down roads we'd rather not go down because we know they lead to suffering for ourselves and others. And it's something karmically that gets worked out, particularly in the meditative process, that we can have confidence in and learn to rest more and more fully in, that also have these experiences of, let's use the Buddhist language here, sensations that have the taste of freedom, signposting us towards the awakening factors. You know, all these wonderful qualities of mindfulness, curiosity, energy, joy, tranquility, absorption, equanimity, you know, all of that is available to us when we begin to open, or when opening begins to reveal itself. And it's like trusting that even though some of those conditions still, it is pointing towards the unconditioned, fractals of the unconditioned that we can get a taste of in community.
In my work with people just speaking about this practically, this sort of funny contradiction, or this is maybe the practical part. I think people hear about things like, oh, open heart and boundless mind. And then there's faking it till you make it, right? So they're like, okay, I'm going to just perform that. I'm going to try, like, what is that? This comes back to the thing about safety. Interestingly, I feel like, especially for people that have been trying on meditation and practice for a while, one of the most supportive things we can do is actually let people know that they can have boundaries. Yeah. And that generates safety. And actually, this often takes place in the more practical spheres of life, rather than having a sense that anything can happen to me at any time, I have no agency, and therefore I armor or I'm contracted to try to protect myself in that scenario. Helping people feel what it feels like to say, no, I don't want something. No, this is enough. I want to stop. Or say, no, you know, this actually doesn't feel loving. I need to stop. If you get that in the body, then people get to actually feel what a yes is. Unless we can feel no, we don't know what yes is. And in having that established, then we can take this approach. Well, what if I just allow myself to feel 10% more? Am I a yes to that? We could do this in meditation. We could do this in a conversation. We can do that just being in a group. Can I feel 5% more? Do I want that? Am I wanting to feel more open now? And then we can feel our longing for connection, our longing to move out from a tight enclosure of how we hold self to something that actually brings in more connection, which then I think can just surprisingly open to trusting that connection, yes, softening into it, which is something we might call boundless or something we might call open.
Thanks, Viveka. That's really reminded me of the retreat I did online during the lockdown, actually, with Singer Sri and Balaji and some of the tools that they shared during that retreat. Very, very practical tools in meditation of how to be with my experience, but not be overwhelmed by it or start to move towards something that's a bit uncomfortable. And those tools have really stayed with me and been really helpful. So I'm glad you brought in that element of what will be shared during the retreat. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for bringing in that wonderful reflection around boundaries. It's interesting how conversations seem to come up around the same time. I've been talking recently with quite a few people about boundaries, just spontaneously. It's been coming up. And this quote from Prentice Hemphill, who's another American somatics practitioner, they are famously quoted saying, boundaries are the distance at which I can love you and me simultaneously. It's so skillful, so beautiful. And that also reminds me, Viveka, of something you said on retreat once that I often repeat to people, which is, how can I help you not hurt me? Which is such a beautiful reflection. When we are in conflict or disharmony with people, how can what we do help that person not accumulate unhelpful karma in terms of how they might then treat us? So boundaries not just help us, but help the people we are setting boundaries with. I mean, a really classic example can be if you are in conflict, but not ready yet to get into communication, you're also helping the other person to take the time and the space to not say something they might regret or that might be hurtful. So what can be seen as impolite society as a snub, actually, it's actually a skillful and loving thing to do for everybody.
I like that, Singer Sri. One of the first poets I think I discovered on my own was Robert Frost, certainly the first American poet. And I remember really responding to his line about good fences make good neighbors. And then I went through a phase much later where I thought, oh no, is that just a really sort of conservative, limiting perspective? That quote you just said, the boundariness, the healthy boundaries aspect of good fences make good neighbors. Just applying that sitting in an intimate setting like a shrine room or an online retreat where you're being quite vulnerable and you're quite exposed and you're trusting other people and they're doing the same with you. And actually, demarcation is important somewhere.
Yeah, some of the wisdom traditions, we mentioned Milarepa before, you know, some of those wisdom traditions, they really are encouragers about boundless heart. But what's really interesting in that, in the boundlessness, it's easy for practitioners to get lost there. Like there can be a place where things start opening, but people get a bit lost, they get a bit confused. So I think this gradual path, support of staying wise and sensitive, this embodiment helps us to be, again, back in the Trikaya, we can be so open, yet that means we're actually more sensitive to the particulars. I know one thing I really appreciated with Sangha Rakshana when I was talking to him about my own journey down these kinds of teachings, his real concern about how we take them up within Tri Ratna, you might call them technically non-dual teachings, or some people recognize these terms like Mahamudra, Dzogchen, this kind of thing. His concern was that it's very easy to lose the ethical dimension. You know, you're like kind of high on the bliss of boundlessness, right? And then have bad boundaries. You don't recognize there's actually another sensitive human being around you. So I feel like this embodied approach brings in wisdom and protection against that kind of side route some people can get lost in.
Just picking up the language of boundless, because I think it can be quite tempting in practice, can't it, to kind of extrapolate from our current view of things and then imagine boundlessness in terms of that scope. What's coming for me is Sangharakshita's teaching on the inconceivable emancipation. There's something deeply mysterious and maybe surprising as you move deeper into the heart about the energies that the deeper heart contains and the direction it wants to go in, particularly around a longing, the emerging of a longing to be free of the restrictions of separation and ego, the deep yearning to be free of the limitations of old age, sickness and death, these difficulties that made the Buddha set out on his quest, and a deep longing for others to be free of suffering, for others to be liberated from that suffering and the intensity of that that the tradition talks about. And in that, for me, is a sense of liberating boundlessness. But that's like such a different country, or not even country, but it's just such a different paradigm from the ego and its insecurities and needing to shore itself up and its cravings and its graspings. So there's something for me deeply mysterious around the boundlessness. And I think the Trikaya teaching communicates this quite well. It talks about this communication from the depths outside of space and time, so to speak.
Well, that's one thing we can promise in October is communication from the depths outside of space and time, which sounds absolutely awesome. Maybe go back to what you were saying, Viveka, in terms of the work we're going to be doing on the retreat itself. There's a bit of a gap to bridge, isn't there, at least when you're listening to this conversation, I think, around that sort of awesome openness and that sort of awesome scope for what it is we're really involved in. And then much more prosaically, I was looking at the list of things you'd flagged up as things you might do on the retreat, somatic work, obviously meditation practice, music, which sometimes gets us into trouble with YouTube's copyright system, if I remember from your last retreat, chanting and ritual, exercises and discussions, you know, teacher input, practice reviews. It's almost like there's a full-bodied approach to it from the three of you. You're kind of operating as a collective organism and you're offering this amazing 360-degree approach to how do we find a way into this work that's meaningful and is really grounded and isn't us just tripping on esoteric ideas of the three bodies. It's actually something that's transformative. And I suppose the way for me to connect to that in this particular conversation is just looking at all of you on screen. I know some of you better than others, but also it's very clear listening. This is actually rooted in your experience of change in your life. You're not just peddling an exotic teaching. And you're not just going to busk a translation of it or something. You're offering this because it's meaningfully transformative. And I wonder if that's a good way to steer the conversation towards its end. Maybe this is a bit of an intimate question, but what are you each working on now that feels like it's transformative? And how does that steer us into the working ground that we're going to share on this retreat? Because it's quite a big invitation, isn't it? Come and do this work with us. Come and do your changing with us.
I suppose just coming off this workshop, it's quite live. It's easy for me. This somatics, trauma and resilience, it's quite easy for me to start us off. Well, we're heading into an election in the United States, which is quite charged. There's a lot of real and implied violence around it. In my social identity, you know, I'm visibly Chinese. And in the recent past, there's been, and currently, you know, there's been an uprise in violence towards people in Chinese Asian bodies. So I know I need to practice within the context of this year. And this is this one moment of this kind of thing happening, flaring up all around our world. In that I touch upon a kind of solidarity. So I've been aware that I could try to endure it. I mean, I do want, just to be frank, I do want to survive it. I could endure it. I'm well-trained to endure, because one of the things about that Chinese training and being from immigrant parents who lived through a war, I've been trained to endure. I would like to do something more fulsome than just endure. So my working ground is to be able to actually have a soft enough body to feel heartbreak and really trust that as a deep source of wisdom and also just how I want to live. I want to live alive. I don't want to be numb this whole year. And then there's also other people I want to be able to connect with. You know, I'm just also quite aware of what's happening, you know, just the long-rooted struggle that's happening in Gaza, the struggle for safety, dignity, and belonging. What just feels so impossible about it for all the people in that conflict, and particularly now in this moment what's happening with even the basic act of trying to get civilians in Palestine, Palestinian civilians, food, housing, that kind of thing. Really appreciating the suffering all around that makes it so hard to imagine something else happening. So yeah, I want to stay alive to the heartbreak of it, you know, polarization is so easy. So that's my practice, soft body, feeling heartbreak, and being resourced to do that, finding resource to do that.
Thanks for sharing that, Vivica.
Yeah, I just appreciate so much what you've shared. And from the vantage point of someone who's been a good friend to you and have practiced alongside you for so long, I really want to mirror back. I see you and your soft heart and all the wonderful things that emerge from you when you're in that space. So many gifts to share with the world that I have benefited greatly from as well. For me, there's something about continuing to sort of lean into a deeper trust of how important appreciating a moment of suffering actually is to our practice. You know, the Buddha, the first noble truth, like really taking that on board, not just as an individual experience, but in this collective moment of so much global suffering and the, you know, complexity of that and the depth of that. And also, you know, back to what you were saying earlier, Viveka, about ancestors. One of the things that I've been really working on, having lost my father last summer, is just really wanting to honor the struggle of my ancestors as well as the efforts that were made for me to be able to live as good a life as I've been able to live, and really wanting to honor the deep value that I was taught, which was, you know, if you've got gifts, your responsibility is to share them. Although that can be taken sometimes the wrong way or used inappropriately, the way I choose to use it is just like appreciating that I do have the capacity to hold space for my own suffering and the suffering of others and to support healing and transformation. And I'm just going to keep doing that. And the more I lean into suffering, interestingly, and again, paradoxically, that word seems to keep coming up, the more energy is freed up to do it more. I think an older version of myself would have felt overwhelmed by that prospect and thinking that I would just collapse or be literally overcome with grief. But actually, I've done enough leaning into grief to know that coming out the other end of it, there's so much energy there and there's so much potential. So I really trust in that these days. And I'm just riding that wave of energy as far as it's going to take me. Watch this space.
Yeah, as you say that, Singhashri, around suffering, it connected me a bit with vulnerability. I feel in terms of my own practice, I've been on quite a journey with vulnerability. I've very effectively blocked it out and denied it. I think it's one of the hardest things for us humans to be present with and feel, and it's very linked, obviously, with suffering. My sense is that it's a really important gateway of the heart, that in practice we're all challenged at some point to open to our vulnerability, which is a truth of the existential situation we're in. By nature, as humans, we are vulnerable. We're not in control. It feels like through that gateway, it's possible then to resonate and really feel at a heart level the vulnerability of others. I can't watch the news now. I touch into the news, but I can't watch it in a way that I could do when I was numb. But now I feel much more connection with people suffering. And I think from that comes energy to want to respond. There's something about opening to suffering and opening to vulnerability that, again, feels like part of a path to boundlessness and expansion. But it's bracing and difficult and takes time and needs support and resourcing. I do wonder in Buddhist circles whether we could talk more about vulnerability. In our conventional culture, or at least in the UK, it's seen as weakness to show vulnerability. Whereas I feel like I'd like to really flip that and see that it's a strength. The spiritual warrior deepens into vulnerability, you know, isn't scared of it, doesn't close down against it, and sees its potential to transform self and other.
Well, that's really beautiful, Balaji. Hearing you say that reminded me, I was listening to a talk of Bhante's on the Sangha, and he was talking about the breaking of all 10 fetters and describing that at the end, well, I don't know if it's the 9th or 10th fetter, but very, very close to final breaking through into the unconditioned, there's a trembling, which is such an embodied word, isn't it? It's like very physical.
a vocation of something. It's not a word that we associate with the mind or with conceptual processes. It's the trembling, which to me is reminiscent of something vulnerable, so receptive, so sensitive.
Thank you, everybody. I was talking to a friend recently. We were having one of those conversations about what does Jorana need to do? What do we need to do? And the word we were kind of knocking around was trustworthiness. In a way, we don't really have to do anything other than just be human and be trustworthy and create trustworthy spaces. It really strikes me that actually just listening to all of you, that's your gift in a way, as you managed to evoke what it's like to trust each other as practitioners and share that really openly and yes, vulnerably, Balajit. And I feel quite confident listening to you that that's the flavour of the space. There's a space people can trust in October that's going to emerge. And the invitation is to bring your body, bring your mind, bring your heart to Three Bodies of Belonging for a week from October 25th, or actually whenever you like, outside of the boundaries of time. You can join that retreat whenever you like and imaginatively connect with the people who were there. Maybe in the far future, people will dig up old computer recordings and watch them and think, what were these beings doing? What were they doing together? Thanks very much to Balajit and to Viveka and to Singhashri for just what you're offering a trustworthy space for everyone out there.
Thank you, Chandradasa. I do hope some folks will be able to be there to help co-create the space. That's what we'll be doing.
Yeah, thanks so much for this opportunity to talk about what we'll be doing. It's lovely to reflect like this on the theme of the retreat. And I also just want to say, especially that Viveka doesn't do a lot of teaching within Jorana these days. So it's a very unique opportunity to be on retreat with her. So if you've ever been curious about her and her teachings or heard good things, this is an opportunity to join her alongside myself and Balajit.
Ending this, I'm just really quite looking forward to seeing what happens at the end of October, you know, when we get together as a community and explore this. And yeah, I'm just very grateful to the Buddhist Center Online for creating a space and doing a lot of the work of getting an event like this off the ground, you know, marketing, publicity and promotion. And I continue to be so impressed with Buddhist Center Online. I just really love the way that these retreats are made available afterwards. Often I hear people getting so much from the online retreats, you know, and there's a real library of riches building up from our Tree Ratna community. And all that takes a lot of time, work and effort, you know, so just wanted to thank Buddhist Center Online for that.
Thanks, Balajit. That's very lovely. We'll share a link in the show notes to all the rest of the riches, so the rest of the retreats that you can tap into. And thanks to you too, Kustadevi, for helping hold the space so well today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you all. I very much appreciated and enjoyed this conversation and have felt myself just in your presence becoming more embodied and connected. And I just think, gosh, that's what we can do just in this sort of space together. So imagine what we could do during a week on retreat. Thank you.
And if you're listening, thank you for your time and just hearing these very beautiful, spontaneous evocations of what Buddhist practice looks like. That's what this podcast is about. You can find, 450 odd other episodes on the page. If you look, you can dip in anywhere you like and meet some amazing voices, amazing minds. We'll be back soon with more stories and tales of practice from the Tree Ratna Buddhist community. But for now, take care and we'll see you again soon.